Hello, and welcome to Towards the Point, a swift glide through the storm clouds of our popular culture. Our theme tonight is origins and location. I'm James Sandy, and with my co-pilot Simon Mobbs, we'll be looking at music, art, and we'll also assess the state of our regional media. If that's not enough for you, there's also a selection of local events for you to put in your notebook. We start tonight with music, and a specific strand of music, in fact, the first rock and roll record. Now, Simon, tell us about this.
Okay, so there's this fantastic CD out called The First Rock and Roll Record, available on Famous Flames Recordings. Now, what this selection of CDs, it's three CDs and over 80 tracks, is attempting to do is maybe give an idea about where the roots of rock and roll are.
It's massive, in fact, isn't it? I think it's 82 tracks. And if you buy a special version of it, if that's not enough, you get another 13 bonus tracks.
Oh, absolutely. And there's some fantastic names on here. I'm glad that I've now got in my MP3 collection the Washboard Rhythm Kings, Big Mama Thornton, and the Mississippi Duke Band. You know, there's some fantastic stuff on here.
I think that's going to get some looks on the train for whoever looks over your shoulder when on your MP3 player. Now, the collection starts with a premise, I think, of what it puts forward as the first rock and roll record, which is a recording from around 1916.
Yeah, yes and no. I mean, that's where it starts out. It kind of pulls up all the strands of what could possibly be the roots. I don't think it tries to answer specifically what is the first one, but it's suggesting that this 1916 record, which is quite an obscure, interesting track.
It is, and it's called the Camp Meeting Jubilee.
The main reason they've got that on there is because of the lyrics. I mean, it's like you say, it's a camp meeting, a religious get-together where they harmonise, and this would have been available, you know, for a couple of dimes to buy this record. And it's got the lyrics, "We've been rocking and a-rolling in your arms, rocking and a-rolling in your arms, in the arms of Moses." Which I think isn't exactly the kind of the connotations we have with new rock and roll, but the fact that it's got rock and roll mentioned in there, I think, was enough for them to include it on the CD.
So that's their starting point. Now, I have to say, the recording, because of the age of the recording, isn't technically brilliant.
No.
The quality of the recording is a little iffy, shall we say. Let's use that term. But you're right, it's recorded at a social gathering, and my take on it, my repeated listening of it, was that there's almost a kind of religious warning built into the song, you know, and it's kind and that, I think, is where, for me, that's where rock and roll starts, because there is this kind of, you know, it is something about attitude, and it's something about rhythm, and there's a good spoon of the devil as well, if you like, kind of thrown in. It's something to be wary of.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think a lot of rock and roll is influenced by blues. You couldn't really have rock and roll without blues. There's a lot of stuff about sexual awareness. There's a lot of stuff about excesses, you know, alcohol for a start. But then there's also this kind of God-fearing, kind of religious undertone to a lot of blues music. And I think rock and roll often has that.
And there are a lot of what I would call traditional blues artists that appear on this collection. You know, you've got Muddy Waters and you've got Robert Johnson, you know. And I think that's probably where blues starts. Although, you know, Sunhouse and others perhaps were there beforehand. Through all of these 82 tracks, whatever, I thought, well, let's have a look kind of online, kind of where the term comes from, where rock and roll as a term, let alone a genre, comes from. And there are three, in my extensive research, there are three kind of areas. There's a suggestion that rock and roll describes the kind of movement of a ship, okay, most plausible. There's also the kind of spiritual fervour that we described in the kind of the camp singing. And there's also this kind of sexual analogy, you know, rocking and rolling. We all know they're talking about a bit of hanky-panky, if you like, there. but also, there's something that in the 50s, a US DJ, Alan Freed, who is also known as Moondog, which was his nickname apparently, coined the term rock and roll and came up with the phrase to describe really music of kind of black origin, and music of with a black musical heritage. And I think that's a really important point, because we have, particularly on this collection, we have a number of songs which are, I suppose, safe white versions of black historical songs, kind of you know, not just from gospel music, but from kind of from slave songs, if you like, and that's quite an interesting diversion, because, you know, classically people will always say Bill Haley, Rock Around the Clock, that's where you start, that's the first rock and roll record. But I think what he did was the kind of first acceptable version of rock and roll, and there's a couple of Bill Haley tracks thrown in here, smattered amongst the among the music. I think that's really interesting. What you can hear actually are some covers, if you like, some songs that clearly have been heavily borrowed, should we say. But within those, you've got, I think, fairly... I suppose there are genuine strands of those songs as well. So you've got Hank Williams' song, for example, which is called Move It On Over, which is really Rock Around the Clock. And it's really also, if you listen to it, Roll Over Beethoven isn't a million miles from that song. So
on the CD, they point out that it's influenced by a song called by Charlie Patton called Going to Move to Alabama. And it's like one thing leads on to another, you know. One artist kind of does a variation of that, and it kind of has a domino effect.
And that's what they're trying to demonstrate here. So they're not trying to, as you've said, they're not trying to say this is the first rock and roll record. What they're saying is that these are significant steps along the journey or parts of the of the movement.
If I was to make an analogy, it's almost if you pull a plant up, you know, you've got lots and lots of roots underneath. And there's just so many different strands to this, isn't there? I mean, if you sort of look at the different genres on the CD, you've got swing, you've got hillbilly country, rhythm, blues, the early spirituals recordings like we mentioned, you've got jazz. There's a whole range of stuff in it, and really you can't have rock and roll without any one of these elements. I mean, maybe you could argue, for example, blues is the most significant influence there, but even so, all of these elements add to what then later becomes rock and roll in, let's say, the early to mid-50s.
For me, there are a couple of tracks that you can identify as real kind of what I would call crossover tracks, where that kind of fusion happens and things kind of go off in different directions. So there's a track on there called Crazy About My Baby, which is Blind Roosevelt Graves. There's another one for your MP3 player. And that has a real kind of sort of ragtime jazz feel. But still, I mean, the elements of kind of rock and roll, the traditional rock and roll sound, are there in the background, or, you know, you can hear through the kind of cadence of it that there's bits of it growing, if you like, which is strange. I have to say, to be critical of the collection, I think there's a lot of stuff missing. Obviously, you know, there's limits to how much you can get on one CD or three CDs. And certainly there are probably rights issues about things you can put in the same place. But there's stuff on there I just don't understand. Maybe you can help me with this. There's Benny Goodman on there, you know, the kind of king of swing, if you like. Why is that on there? There's the Andrews Sisters, which I have to rule out in any kind of musical discussion, I'm afraid. And then Judy Garland. Now, why is Judy Garland on there?
Well, my understanding about the Judy Garland one is that in 1943 film called Thousands Cheer, she actually used the term rocking, and she's one of the first people in popular culture to use the term rocking. Don't associate Judy Garland with the term let's rock. But maybe that's partly something to do with it. And a lot of the time I found that the tracks, they didn't necessarily feel like rock and roll, but because they had rock and roll somewhere in the lyrics, and as we mentioned before, particularly with the sort of, you know, the sexual innuendo, as long as it had rock and roll in there, it kind of, they felt they could put it in there, because it's just, it's interesting, if not anything else.
It was a bit risky. And in fact, there's one, isn't there, somewhere, I think it's the Andrews Sisters song, which is a lullaby, which is Rock-a-bye Baby. So they get the rock word in there, which is, again, you know, sort of sneaking it in, sort of being a bit cheeky, I suppose, in terms of the context. It is one for nerds, I think, maybe. It's one for the aficionados, for the lovers of rock and roll. And but there is stuff in there, and you've mentioned Elvis Presley, you know, who people instantly associate with rock and roll. And they've got the Carl Perkins version of Blue Suede Shoes, and they've got other versions of That's All Right Mama and all those kind of things. Some of the discs dwell too much on the kind of, this is a social study of rock and roll.
But it's,
rather than, you know, this is just good music that comes in that bracket.
Yeah. I mean, the CD is based on a book, as you mentioned, the 1982 book, What Was the First Rock and Roll Record. You know, if you're going to base something on a book like that and have basically more or less all the tracks from it, it might kind of have that slightly dusty sort of, you know, kind of connotation. But I think within here, there's a lot. I mean, I think maybe three quarters of the tracks I'd definitely want to like condense down onto a playlist and listen to again and again. Maybe the earlier ones I might skip past a little bit. They're interesting the first couple of listens. But yeah, there's some great stuff on here.
The first rock and roll record is available on the Famous Flames label. And I think it came out towards the end of last year. It was in November last year. And we're very pleased on the programme to have asked an expert, a rock and roll expert, Dr. Dave Allen, who's a principal lecturer at the University of Portsmouth. He's also a DJ on Express FM. But we asked him about his thinking about the first rock and roll record.
Personally, I'm of that generation that I do remember Bill Haley and Rock Around the Clock. And at the time, of course, we thought that was. And then in 56, the Elvis records came out in Britain. And I was pretty young at the time, but was conscious of them, you know. And so, again, maybe something like Hound Dog or Jailhouse Rock. And then, you know, if you end up like me, some sad old bloke who spends his entire life immersed in popular music, you know, one of the things we do, and we're mostly blokes, I'd have to say. I think it's a bloke thing. One of the things that we do is we kind of dig away and try and find some rare track that nobody else has found. So you're the first one, you know. And so a really famous track was Rock at 88, which came out in about 51, 52, on the Sun label, which was the label that Elvis started on. And it was essentially Ike Turner's band, Ike and Tina Turner. It was Ike Turner's band, although it's often credited to Jackie Brenston, who was the vocalist. So for years, that became the cult thing. But I think in the end you do play this cult game of trying to find, you know, because then you find tracks from rhythm and blues tracks from the 40s and 30s where people use the term rock and the term roll. They're mostly black. I mean, I have a very simple take on this. I think it's a really fantastic thing to talk about. It's, you know, it's much more interesting at dinner parties than the Euro, you know, and you can all kind of throw these ideas around. And in the end, you know, you come to this point, as I am in my 60s, where you think, I'm never going to get there, but I'm never going to tire of talking about it. Particularly through the 40s, you get rhythm and blues that's quite jazz influenced, quite big band influenced, so lots of saxophones and keyboards in it. So one of the big changes in the 50s, one of the key things about rock and roll as we often talk about it these days, white rock and roll, is the role of the electric guitar. So Bill Haley's a guitarist. Elvis starts as a guitarist with Scotty Moore on guitar. And there's no saxophones and trumpets with Elvis at all, you know. Whereas you go back to Louis Jordan, Wynonie Harris and all those people, that, you know, the black rhythm and blues guys that are really, you know, some of Joe Turner's early stuff is pure rock and roll. A lot of it has got saxophones and trumpets. And even when you strip it down on this particular collection, and there's this wonderful, wonderful track from the late 30s called Rollin' Pete by Pete Johnson, the boogie-woogie pianist, and Joe Turner, the singer. So there's just piano and vocal, but it's rock and roll. I mean, you can't dispute it. It is rock and roll. It just wasn't called rock and roll at the time. But again, it's piano rather than guitar. So it's the shift from black to white, and it's the shift towards the emphasis on guitar. I think Keith Richard put it this way. I think he once said, if you listen to Rolling Stones, Jagger is rock and I'm roll. And I think he's absolutely right. I think Keith Richard and Charlie Watts are the people that give the Rolling Stones rock and roll. For me, they're not a classic rock band. They're a classic rock and roll band. Almost everything that came after that for me is rock music. And some of it I like and some of it I'm not so fond of. But I will always be more fond of rock and roll. And I suppose at the end of the day, if it comes down to one thing more than anything else, one thing, it's the backbeat. It's that, you know, it's 1, 2, 3, 4, but it's actually 2, 4, 2, 4. It's that 2 and 4. It's that, yeah. You know, it's that. And that's what I don't always hear in somebody like U2. For instance, and that's a matter of taste. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with U2, but that's rock music rather than rock and roll for me. That's the distinction I would draw.
Let's put this together.
We move now to art and an exhibition called Quarantania. Now I'm confused, Simon. Maybe you can help me about this. There's a dead donkey, there are people in cages, and there are 4x4s. Covered in fur. What on earth brings all this stuff together?
Just a normal Saturday night in Southsea.
Indeed.
Quarantania is an exhibition that's taking place at the John Hansard Gallery in Southampton. And it's three artists, international artists, one from America with Indian roots, one from the Czech Republic, and one from Russia. All three artists deal with kind of social, political, or philosophical content within their work. Generally speaking, the work is all something to do with the fact that the individual and how they interact with others in a larger whole. So that could be the individual within society, the individual within an education system, things like that. You mentioned about these quite shocking images, quite interesting images that appear in the catalogue. The curator has described the work as all having something in common, which is the poetry of the absurd.
Now, I saw that term, and I'm not clear what that means, the poetry of the absurd. That sounds quite arty in my book. That sounds quite arty. But I think they're trying to kind of make quite complex relationships more accessible for people. Is that one thing they're trying to do?
Yeah, that could be a good way of looking at it. I mean, there's a quote here from the curator, David Thorpe. They, the artists, each cite the individual within a different group context as they explore their personal lives and their relationship with historical, natural and present-day social environments.
You see, again, that sounds quite arty. There's something about disconnection, it strikes me, about the exhibition, more than interconnectivity.
Yeah. I mean, the actual title, Quarantania, comes from a title of an artwork by the artist Louise Bourgeois, a major 20th century artist. And she created a piece which was about feeling on the outsides whilst within a unit, which could be a family unit, could be a work unit, that kind of thing. And she described the work as being about the duel between the isolated individual and the shared awareness of the group. Another arty quote for us there.
There's lots. And from someone with the surname Bourgeois. Even though we're losing listeners by the second, perhaps. But there's some interesting stuff in here. Tell us a bit about the most kind of eye-catching stuff is the fur 4x4s.
Yeah. So just to give a quick overview, the exhibition's got three artists, three different areas, and each artist has their own room or selection of rooms. First artist you see is Taos Makacheva, and the piece you refer to is called The Fast and the Furious. If we just, you and me could just have a quick couple of the images, and these should be available on our blog as well.
Again, we're breaking boundaries by describing art on the radio. And really, I mean, this looks like a Toyota Land Cruiser. Other 4x4s are available, of course, covered in fake fur. And now there's a teacup as well. There's a teacup covered in fur. And this appears to be in the rural hinterlands of what used to be the Soviet Union somewhere. Is that right?
Yeah, the piece here by Taos Makeva called The Fast and the Furious is set around the capital of Dagestan. There's a new highway opened up towards the airport. And what you've got is this subculture of young men who go and drive 4x4 vehicles illegally. They have races and they kind of posture with these vehicles, and it's about souping them up. Who can? You
know. Is this kind of Pimp My Ride territory?
Absolutely. Very, very masculine, you know, very kind of like, you know, I'm going to, my car's more shiny than yours, that kind of thing. Now, she wanted to kind of infiltrate this subculture. So as part of this art project, what she's done is she's bought a 4x4 vehicle and decorated it with animal furs, which she's bought from kind of flea markets in Moscow. So she's kind of put these fantastic furs all over this car and then taken it out into the highway and into these places where the young men kind of congregate to, you know, show off their cars to see what happens. Yeah, as you could probably see from the video, the responses have actually been very enthusiastic. They're not quite sure what to make of it. They think it's pretty cool, but they're also a little bit perplexed at the same time.
So she's, I guess from what you just said, she's trying to make some kind of point, I think, about subcultures and the kind of politics of a group. Mm. And she's trying to find out in some way how easy it is to become or infiltrate those groups. So there's a lot, actually, more than it's not just furry cars.
It's funny to look at, isn't it? When you see these guys' reactions, you know, it's a fantastic mix of kind of... They're very intrigued and they think this is just a great way to pimp your car. But they're also like a little bit perplexed. I think one of the things she said is that she's quite pleased, but they didn't see it as an art project. They saw it as just an interesting way to do up the car. But the fact that she's chosen fur is in some ways quite a feminine way to a kind of adorn a car, and this very masculine subculture she's going into. But that didn't seem to bother them so much. They're interested in the way that the fur fits around the doors and all that kind of stuff.
There's also something, I suppose, about the natural world overtaking something that's very technical, mechanical, industrial.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And like kind of man-made objects versus animals, that kind of thing. Yeah, so I've definitely, you know, a woman in a subculture, animal matter in a man-made structure, you know, an outsider being welcomed or at least kind of accepted into a subculture.
What else have we got in this exhibition? There's lots of weird and wonderful things. Tell us about the people in cages.
Okay, so the artist Eva Kotakova, what we're looking at here is examples of kind of fantastical structures which used to aid, for example, posture, used to aid education, you know, people learning, that kind of thing. So the first image we're looking at here is this kind of young girl sat at a desk, and there's various kind of realigning kind of structures to keep her head straight, to keep her hands in the right position behind her chair, that kind of thing. it looks a little bit imposing, doesn't it?
It's quite severe, isn't it? It seems to be constricting. I'm not 100% comfortable with that image, but there we are. Is there something there about constraint, about physical constraint and mental constraint, in the sense that they're obviously almost being bound to their desk to learn, which actually is causing them to do probably everything but learn?
There's a quote from this artist where she says that education, school, is a very important space where children are influenced. And she says that it's the second biggest structure after the family, where children are controlled and confronted with how society functions. So she's obviously got these very strong opinions about education here. And looking at these, they look like a bit of a satire of education. Like, sometimes we do these things to try and better our children, but actually we're just making them feel uncomfortable or maybe a bit bored.
Now tell us, one image that I was struck by in the catalogue for this exhibition was what really I have to describe as a man with a large wooden funnel on his head. I'm sure it's not called that because most modern art is called untitled. You'll know that better than I. So what's the story behind that?
I think this is part of a similar kind of idea. Maybe this one's not directly linked to education as much, but what's happening here is it's a space where somebody can enter into and kind of get away from it all, maybe. You know, they kind of can't see what's around them in the room. But it's just going back to this idea of a poetry of the absurd. It doesn't actually properly work. It just looks a bit odd. And there's another guy here who's upside down in the middle of a desk, held by some kind of frame.
There are novel ways, I have to say, to achieve relaxation stroke isolation. I think the MP3 player might be an easier way to get some escapism.
I think one of my favourite ones in this series is this chaise lounge here, which has got a cage all around it, and then a book propped up that you can, you know, it's meant to be at eye height.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't look like a particularly inviting place to lie down in. It doesn't look like a particularly inviting place to read. And also, I noticed that the actual content of the book is about learning how to fly. So there's kind of like an irony there. You know, you're never going to be able to fly with a cage around you like that. I think what she's commenting on is, you know, the way sometimes structures, whether it be education or other structures, are trying to aid us and make us feel comfortable and aid learning, but it can end up sometimes becoming a bit too stifling.
Tell us about the third artist as well, Naya Choksi.
Okay, so Naya Choksi is a conceptual artist. She makes a lot of video installations. The one that left the biggest impact on me was one called Leafful. Okay, so what you've got here is a 15-minute video, and what she's done, she's employed workers, or they could be actors, to build this structure around a tree, and it looks a bit rickety, but it's quite efficient, quite grid-like. And then these people have been employed to basically de-leaf the tree, one leaf at a time.
And could a strong wind not do that, or...?
Well, there's quite a lot of leaves here, and it's the middle of summer by the looks of it. But yeah, so they basically de-leaf the tree, and she, over the course of a day or so, and she records them doing this. And what you get is this quite slow, meditative kind of video as the workers slowly pluck off the leaves. And along the way, they kind of muse and they talk about what they're doing. One guy says, what dark purpose is there to remove your many individual stalks? What is lost and what is gained. So they start kind of questioning the reasons behind them taking these leaves off the tree. And then at the end of the day, about dusk time, the tree is more or less de-leaved, apart from three solitary leaves that are at the top. And then these children come and pick up the leaves, put them into baskets, have a bit of fun, and then wander off. And as I say, you're left with just these kind of three solitary leaves at the top. I think you can kind of read symbolism into this.
What happens if they blow away, I think, is my question. You know, is the whole piece ruined?
Well, she got it on video.
So yeah, I suppose.
She's happy. I think what she's looking at here is the way that man-made structures, man-made systems could maybe depleting natural resources. Maybe there's beauty in it, but ultimately, you know, they're kind of taking the leaves away from this tree. There's something kind of sad about the video, but also beautiful at the same time.
There's something, I think, in that for me about systematically breaking down a system, if you see what I mean. You know, yeah. Making something very structured unstructured.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah. A man-made system systematically breaking down a natural system. Yeah.
I think we're already in the realms of art review there, so we better stop. Let's, in terms of the exhibition, just, give me a sense of your enjoyment of it. Was it something that you found challenging, or was it something you thought, I'm not convinced by these dead donkeys?
for dead donkeys. The donkey's not actually dead.
Okay.
The donkey is...
That's important for the children listening, I think.
The donkey is put under anaesthetic. I think in that piece, Nia Choksi, she puts herself under anaesthetic as well as three animals. And then the animals wake up before she does and start interacting with it before she's coming out of the anaesthetic. Out of being unconscious, but no animals were actually killed. No animals were actually harmed.
Okay, well, I'm reassured. I'm reassured to hear that. Tell us where we can see the exhibition. I think it's on till 9th of June.
The exhibition Quarantania takes place at the John Hansard Gallery, which is attached to the University of Southampton, and is on until the 9th of June. Admission is free, and if you'd like more information, you can visit www.hansardgallery.org.uk.
We move now to Arts World, and more specifically, the relocation of the British media.
So in particular, there's this Media City being set up in Salford, Manchester. What's your take on that, James?
Well, this is the big exciting news, really, that a lot of the BBC, BBC North, have been shifted to Greater Manchester, to Salford, and there's a purpose-built kind of island, really, of all kinds of media things. They've got lots of studio space there, because obviously they need it. ITV are also shifting in. They've created a media village, which is designed, I think, to kind of hothouse a number of smaller media companies. They've got things like satellite information services, which I think is designed to beam their great product across the globe. Interestingly, the university are moving students there, some of the residences as well. They're moving across to Media City. They've got a metro link, which means you can get there, which is always a bonus. And if that's not enough, they've got a Costa and a WH Smith, so you can get your coffee and your newspaper as well. So I think it's a really interesting development, because it says something about, you know, it recognises Manchester, I think, as a kind of cultural hub and an area of great media activity. But it's also saying that this is a national centre, not just a regional centre. You know, we have flagship programmes now that we will shift to this part of the world. And I think, for me, what I'm interested in most of all is the kind of relationship between a location and its kind of creative industry, and whether locating things in a certain place will naturally, you know, kind of bring forth a whole wave of creativity. And that's something we've discussed previous terms of, you know, Portsmouth always described or kind of compared unfairly in some ways to Brighton, or people, you know, like to sort of say Little Brighton is developing in Portsmouth. And there's a lot of cultural activity here, but I wonder kind of how infrastructure impacts on that, whether, you know, whether buildings make the difference at the end of the day.
Yeah, there's a lot of factors, isn't there? I mean, like you say, Brighton's this kind of amazing centre for arts, for music. There's a whole range of boutique shops there to go and have a look around. There's a lot of stuff going on, isn't there? I mean, also politically, it's the one place in the UK where the Green Party have been elected.
It's very green.
And it's got the biggest gay, lesbian and bisexual community within.
It's very
UK.
Pink as well, yeah.
Very green and very pink. Yeah. And yeah, so it's a very unique place, isn't it? And in some ways, Southsea is sometimes described as being a little Brighton, and I think what they're referring to is the element of independent shops. It's got a music scene. There's a slightly kind of cool edge to Southsea, and that's what it's referring to. But as you pointed out, the kind of very specific set of things that allow Brighton to be what it is are very hard to duplicate elsewhere.
They are, and if you look at things like Gunwharf Quays, for example, Portsmouth, you know, they're... It's very clear that the focus of that is retail and leisure and entertainment. You know, people go there for a pint and a pie and, you know, some Prada if they're, you know, feeling in the mood. Now, the BBC has a centre in Gunwharf, but it doesn't have anything on the scale of Media City, Salford. Now, the other thing that's happening in terms of our media, in terms of a regional shift, is a number of newspapers, particularly those owned by the Johnson Group, are changing how they're configured and how they're managed. Some of them are doing away with editors or editors-in-chief, and they are replacing them with kind of managing directors, if you like, who are very national figures. And that's having an impact, because that's in some way detaching, I think, from the kind of the local scene. It's making very numbers-driven news and very numbers-driven output. The other thing that's happening also is, and it's happened to a number of papers and publications, is they're moving to a kind of weekly version rather than a daily. So it says something about not just the kind of production of our local media, but I think the kind of journalism and the kind of the quality of journalism, and whether journalists can continue to operate in the same way as they've always done. Just before we go, we've just got time to tell you about a couple of events happening locally. If you fancy a bit of cabaret, well, why not go along to the Groundlings Theatre? You can see Berlin 1931 in all its swinging glory, and the show also includes dinner with waiters to serve you at the bar. Show dates start from the 31st of May through to the 16th of June. And if you really fancy letting it all go, then why not go along to Portsmouth's Naked Bike Ride on Southsea Common on the 26th of May? It's a 40-minute ride around Portsmouth in the Bath. What more could you want? I can't guarantee I'll be there, but I'll be with them in spirit. Simon, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's it from this show. We'll be back again soon. Thanks for listening. Towards the Point is a King of the Buttons production for 93.7 Express FM.